Chapter 1. By all accounts, Dorothy Kilgallen was fascinated with the life and times and the death of Marilyn Monroe, and through this fascination and additional accounts of Worth, it is possible to learn a great deal about the brunette-turned-bleach-blonde screen siren born Norma Jean Mortensen on June 1, 1926, making her 13 years younger than Kilgallen. Like every competent journalist at the time, Kilgallen knew of the tough road the California native traveled during a rough-and-tumble childhood. Unfortunately, accounts by biographers through the years leading up to her death during the evening hours of August 4, 1962, play with the truth just like various biographers do when attempting to chronicle what happened in 1963 before, during, and after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. In Norma Jean's case, most all of the biographers do not separate fact from fiction, relying instead on rumor and speculation, and thus distorting the truth about the human side of her that is the most amazing part of the woman who would become Marilyn Monroe. Even vaunted author Joyce Carol Oates had the audacity to distort that truth when she wrote the book Blonde, a Novel, in 2000, and promoted it with this description. In this ambitious book, Joyce Carol Oates boldly reimagines the inner, poetic, and spiritual life of Norma Jean Baker, the child, the woman, the faded celebrity, and idolized blonde the world came to know as Marilyn Monroe. In a voice startling, intimate, and rich, Norma Jean tells her own story, that of an emblematic American artist, intensely conflicted and driven, who has lost her way. A powerful portrait of Hollywood's myth and an extraordinary woman's heartbreaking reality, Blonde is a sweeping epic that pays tribute to the elusive magic and devastation behind the creation of the great 20th-century American star. Despite admitting that the story was fictionalized by way of the subtitle A Novel, and that the author reimagines what happened, Oates and those who produced the ludicrous film of the same name in 2001 publicized both as Marilyn's own story, which is extraordinarily misleading since she would have never distorted the facts, as is the case since the story told was based mostly on speculation and very few primary sources. The book and film are thus both an insult to one of America's most talented and celebrated entertainers, and she would have been ashamed of the performance of an obscure Australian actress, Poppy Montgomery, since no one could play Marilyn except Marilyn. Following their deaths, and through to the present day, both Marilyn and Dorothy Kilgallen suffered false witness, especially from those so-called experts who neither knew them in their prime nor lived during the time of their careers. Similarly, with almost no exception, those who later wrote about the JFK assassination, other than Dorothy Kilgallen, were not in Dallas either before or during the few days following the president's death, and thus could not report a first-hand account of what took place. Regardless, as will be explained, these experts, especially modern-day authors, rely on speculation leading to multiple distortions of history. Fortunately, like Kilgallen and her articles and columns, Marilyn left behind a historical record of importance in her unfinished book, My Story, finally published in 1974. Skepticism has run rampant regarding whether she actually wrote the book, but substantial proof exists that with the help of collaborator, Academy Award-winning screenwriter Ben Hecht, Marilyn was indeed the author. Also, if one compares the word usage in this book with additional writings by Marilyn provided in a future chapter, Marilyn's voice rings true in My Story. If no other book is read about the talented actress's existence during her 36 years on Earth, this one must be, since it drips with emotion on every page as she describes, in her own words, her life from birth and her own struggles to a time when she became the most famous actress in the world. Marilyn's story opens with her explaining, I thought the people I lived with were my parents. The woman said to me one day, "Don't call me Mama. You're old enough to know better. I'm not related to you in any way. You just board here. Your mama's coming to see you tomorrow. You can call her Mama if you want to." Marilyn was born as the third child of Gladys Pearl Baker in the charity ward at Los Angeles County Hospital. The man she assumed to be her father was a letter carrier, and she would pepper him with questions about various subjects, piquing the curiosity of every young girl. She wrote that while others never answered these questions, he did so. Marilyn wrote that the man and woman she believed to be her parents weren't mean, they were just poor, and so she helped out by scrubbing floors, washing dishes, and running errands. Of her mother, who finally did visit, Marilyn recalled, "When I said, 'Hello, Mama,' she stared at me. She had never kissed me or held me in her arms or hardly spoken to me. When I think of her now, my heart hurts me twice as much as it used to when I was a little girl. It hurts me for both of us." Marilyn's mother paid $5 a week to the letter carrier to take care of her. But during one visit to her mother's rooms, she kept looking at a photograph on the wall. When her mother noticed, she said, "That's your father." And Marilyn wrote, "I felt so excited I almost fell off the chair. It felt so good to have a father, to be able to look at his picture and know I belonged to him." Describing the photo, Marilyn, who had been devastated when her dog, Tippy, was shot by a neighbor, wrote, "My father wore a slouch hat with a little gaily on the side. There was a lovely smile in his eyes, and he had a thin mustache like Clark Gable. I felt very warm toward the picture, and this was my first happy time, finding my father's picture." But the happy time was soon extinguished when Marilyn's mother, suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, was carted off to the nearby Norwalk Mental Hospital after a frightening episode, which included screaming and laughing in an outrageous manner. "To the rescue," Marilyn wrote, "came Grace, her mother's best friend, who worked as a film librarian at Columbia Pictures." Marilyn recalled that she was the first person who ever patted my head or touched my cheek. That happened when I was 8. According to Marilyn's account, if Grace was strapped for money, she would stand in line at the nearby Holmes Bakery for hours and then pay 25 cents for a sack full of old bread. After Grace told her, "Don't worry, Norma Jean, you're going to be a beautiful girl when you grow up. I can feel it in my bones," Marilyn wrote, "Her words made me so happy that the stale bread tasted like cream puffs." In Marilyn's best interest, due to lack of money to take proper care of the youngster and as her legal guardian, Grace sent her to the Los Angeles Orphans Home Society. There she was given a blue dress and white shirtwaist to wear and shoes with heavy soles, and was placed with families for safekeeping who were paid a few dollars a week to look after her. Before she married at 16, Marilyn drifted between several families. She wrote that one family with whom I lived was so poor that I was often scolded for flushing the toilet at night. Like many little girls, Marilyn had dreams, writing, "When I was 5, I think, that's when I started wanting to be an actress. I didn't like the world around me because it was kind of grim, but I loved to play house. It was like you could make your own boundaries. When I heard this was what actresses do, I said, that's what I want to be. Some of my foster families used to send me to the movies to get me out of the house, and there I'd sit all day and way into the night. Up in front, there with the screen so big, a little kid all alone, and I loved it." In My Story, Marilyn recalled, "I daydreamed chiefly about beauty. I dreamed of myself becoming so beautiful that people would turn to look at me when I passed. I dreamed of myself walking proudly in beautiful clothes and being admired by everyone and overhearing words of praise." But instead of being praised, the young Marilyn encountered abuse when a man she called Mr. Kimmel, who was renting a room from one of her foster families, molested her. She wrote that after he called her to his room and locked the door, he said, "Now you can't get out," and I stood staring at him. I was frightened, but I didn't dare yell. I knew if I yelled, I would be sent back to the orphanage in disgrace again. Describing what happened next, Marilyn wrote, "When he put his arms around me, I kicked and fought as hard as I could, but I didn't make any sound. He was stronger than I was and wouldn't let me go." She recalled that Mr. Kimmel then handed her a nickel and said, "Go buy yourself some ice cream," whereupon the molested girl said she threw the nickel in his face. Marilyn wrote that, "After Mr. Kimmel unlocked the door and let me go, I ran to the woman I called my aunt to tell her what he had done. She interrupted, 'Don't you dare say anything against Mr. Kimmel. He's a fine man, my star boarder,' in an angry tone." Unlike Dorothy Kilgallen, who grew up in a stable environment where she was praised, Marilyn, not technically an orphan but certainly abandoned by her mother, had difficulty with youngsters in the neighborhood, writing, "In school the pupils often whispered about me and giggled as they stared at me. They called me dumb and made fun of my orphan's outfit. I didn't mind being called dumb. I knew I wasn't." Regarding sex, Marilyn wrote, "I wasn't aware of anything sexual in boys liking me, and there were no sex thoughts on my mind when I was young. I didn't think of my body as having anything to do with sex. It was more like a friend who had mysteriously appeared in my life, a sort of magic friend. When I was 13, I stood in front of a mirror one morning and put lipstick on my lips. I darkened my blonde eyebrows. The lipstick and the mascara were like clothes I didn't have. I saw that they improved my looks as much as if I had put on a real gown." Monroe's first visit to the beach in a skimpy bathing suit caused her to write in My Story, "I paid no attention to the whistles and whoops. In fact, I didn't hear them. I was full of a strange feeling as if I were two people. One of them was Norma Jean from the orphanage who belonged to nobody. The other was someone whose name I didn't know. But I knew where she belonged. She belonged to the ocean and the sky and the whole world." To avoid being returned to the orphanage, Marilyn married Jim Doherty, who worked the night shift at Lockheed Aircraft. She wrote, "The first effect marriage had on me was to increase my disinterest in sex. Actually, our marriage was a sort of friendship with sexual privileges. I found out later that marriages are often no more than that, and that husbands are chiefly good as lovers when they are betraying their wives." Marilyn's comment about sex differs greatly from the account Doherty provided in his book, The Secret Happiness of Marilyn Monroe, published in 1976. In the preface, he wrote, "I think it's time the facts were set straight about my relationship with Marilyn Monroe as the first of her three husbands." He began by writing, "Norma Jean and I had a very normal, beautiful life while it lasted, which included friends, family, and the great outdoors, which she loved. While in high school, Doherty was president of the student body and a member of the drama group that produced a play called Shirt Sleeves, in which his daughter was played by none other than the future motion picture star Jane Russell. Norma Jean recalled that Doherty drove a nifty 1940 Ford Sport Coupe at the time, and she became interested in him because he was a big wheel on the Van Nuys High School campus. During that time, Doherty noted his bride admired a diverse group of men, including General Douglas MacArthur, Franklin Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and Mahatma Gandhi. He wrote, "I never knew Norma Jean to have really close girlfriends." He explained that this situation traced back to her high school days, when other girls snubbed her because she had such big bosoms. She tried to look less conspicuous by wearing very loose blouses that concealed her breasts. Concealing them didn't mean she wasn't proud of her breasts. After she became a model, a woman working at a photo agency asked her if she wanted some small falsies. According to Doherty, Marilyn roared, "I don't use falsies. These are all mine." Regarding the marriage to Marilyn, Doherty explained that when Irwin Doc Goddard and his wife Grace, who had been looking after Marilyn while her mother experienced mental issues, moved to West Virginia, Doherty's mother approached him and said, "Grace wants to know if you would be interested in marrying Marilyn." Doherty learned that if the marriage didn't happen, Norma Jean would have to return to the orphanage. Amenable to the arrangement, Doherty began courting Marilyn, taking her boating at a little place up the hills known as Pop's Willow Lake, great for lovers. The couple also went hiking in the Hollywood Hills and parked on what he called the notorious Mulholland Drive, where they did what most couples do, a lot of kissing and a lot of hugging. Regarding sex, Doherty wrote that Norma Jean once confided in Grace, "Jim's such a wonderful person and I want to marry him, but I don't know anything about sex. Can we get married without sex?" Grace had told her, according to Doherty, "Jim will teach you." The marriage was consummated on June 19, 1942. Norma Jean was 16, Doherty 21. Of Marilyn's psyche at the time, her husband wrote, "She was a Gemini. There were moods in her that were unpredictable and often a little scary. You'd catch glimpses of someone who had been unloved for too long, unwanted too many years." He added, "There were two Norma Jeans. One was the child whose dolls and stuffed animals were propped up on top of the chest of drawers. There were two ceramic crybaby dolls from her earlier years, a stuffed teddy bear with one eye, a French decorator doll, a stuffed monkey with no tail, and two rag dolls, her favorites." Indicating Norma Jean's sensitivity at an early age, Doherty wrote, "One rainy day she saw a cow out the window standing in the rain." He added, "Norma Jean wanted to bring it into the living room." Happy memories of Doherty's included his recalling, "She had this cute little voice, kind of soft, not much volume, but it was sweet, and she always sang on key. She sang, 'I'll be with you in apple blossom time,' sung by the Andrews sisters, and 'When You Wish Upon a Star,' both popular songs at the time." As for the intimate part of the marriage, Doherty wrote, "There was no pretense in how Marilyn and I felt about each other. I had known a number of young women intimately, but never had I encountered a girl who so thoroughly enjoyed sexual union. It made our lovemaking pure joy." Doherty wrote that Marilyn's sexual appetite was quite strong. While they were driving along, he had a feeling she wanted to be intimate, but he'd say, "Honey, we've got a home and a beautiful bed." But she'd lean against my chest and look up at me and sigh, "It's more romantic out here." So we'd park there and do it. Making love for Marilyn was just another way of giving. Such an attitude, it will be shown, contributed to how the future famous actress dealt with men, powerful men, including both John and Robert Kennedy, during troubled times in the future. Of the girl Norma Jean, who became the woman Marilyn, Doherty wrote, "She had no awareness that she was beautiful. She wanted to be. She would rinse her face as many as 15 times because she wanted a perfect complexion. She had a quick wit and a beautiful face and body. She was the most mature 16-year-old I had ever met when we married, and she kept on maturing throughout our marriage." He added, "She had the cleanest kind of beauty I've ever seen." The big break for young Marilyn, Dorothy Kilgallen knew, happened during the World War II years when photographer David Conover, part of a motion picture unit shooting morale-boosting photos of factory workers, spotted the dicey doll who was working in an airplane factory. His photos of her triggered a pin-up modeling career that would lead to stardom. Jim Doherty agreed with the big break part, writing, "My own future was in jeopardy the moment that armed photographer clicked his shutter." Excited about the prospects of a modeling career, Norma Jean signed with the Blue Book Modeling Agency, located in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Emmeline Snively had seen Marilyn's photograph in the Soldier magazine and contacted her. The young beauty's entrance into the entertainment business as a teenager had begun. One of the rubs of Marilyn's marriage was Doherty's disapproval of her obsession with her modeling career and its cost. He became upset with her buying clothes to the extent that she pawned their silverware to take care of expenses. Finally, Doherty said he told his wife, "You will have to choose between a modeling career and maybe the movies or a home life with me." Norma Jean chose the former, and after deciding the marriage was over in January 1946, she filed for divorce. Of that decision, Doherty wrote, "I'm sorry she made the decision she did, but here you have a person who has lived a pretty sheltered life, and suddenly she is about to hit the big time. Money, fame, all those things. I think she even considered both fame and the possible huge earnings as points of security." At age 19, Marilyn, according to My Story, moved to Hollywood to find out who I was. On Sundays, when she was lonely, she'd visit Union Station, where she met many poor people. In her book, Marilyn showed her skill as a writer and how insightful she was at the time. You learned a lot watching poor people. You learned that pretty wives adored homely men, and good-looking men adored homely wives, and that people in shabby clothes, carrying raggedy bundles, and with three or four sticky kids clinging to them, had faces that could light up like Christmas trees when they saw each other. And you watched really homely men and women, fat ones and old ones, kiss each other as tenderly as if they were lovers in a movie. Marilyn learned firsthand that Hollywood life was full of potholes. She wrote, "The Hollywood I knew was the Hollywood of failure. Fame, fame, but not a hello for us girls. We ate at drugstore counters, we sat in waiting rooms, we were the prettiest tribe of panhandlers that ever overran a town. And there were so many of us, beauty contest winners, flashy college girls, homegrown sirens from every state in the Union, from cities and farms, from factories, vaudeville circuits, dramatic schools, and one from an orphan asylum." The future movie star added, "Around us were the wolves. Not the big wolves inside the studio gate, but the little ones, the talent agents without offices, press agents without clients, contact men without contacts, and managers. The drugstores and cheap cafes were full of managers, ready to take you over if you enrolled under their banner. Their banner was usually a bedsheet." By this time, Marilyn's photo was posted on the covers of several popular magazines, including Family Circle, Laugh, Peek, C, and USA. Gossip columns reported that Howard Hughes had been impressed with her photogenic qualities. No wonder, since in 1946, photographer Laszlo Willinger had said of Marilyn, "When she saw the camera, she just lit up." Based on the media exposure, Marilyn was given a screen test at 20th Century Fox. When studio head Daryl Zanuck viewed it, he approved a 7-year contract with a 6-month option clause. The salary? $75 a week, which translates into a bit more than $1,000 in today's currency. In a signal that Marilyn would take her acting seriously, she attended classes in drama, dance, music, and speech, the latter after telling her mother, "I have to improve my enunciation and vowels." Limited roles in films for 20th Century Fox and Columbia Pictures from 1946 to 1948 led to a decent contract with Fox in 1951. By then, Dorothy Kilgallen had established herself not only as a powerful columnist, but as a star on what would become a long-running television show. To provide more flair for the budding actress, Fox executive Ben Lyon decided she needed a change of name. Regarding this happening, Jim Doherty recalled in his book, "I asked where they'd dreamed up that name, and she said she had taken Marilyn from a grandmother on one side and Monroe from one of her grandmother Della's husbands." When Marilyn asked him, "What do you think of it?" Jim said he replied, "It's beautiful, just beautiful," and noticed she just beamed, she just lit up. An alternative version of that story, and arguably the most likely, appears to stem from the short-term Fox contract the actress had signed in 1946. At the time, Lyon swore he was responsible for the name change, and that choosing Marilyn came from her reminding him of Broadway star Marilyn Miller, and Monroe from her mother's maiden name. This meant that Marilyn, like Dorothy Kilgallen, and for that matter both John and Robert Kennedy, was of Irish descent through her grandmother, Della Mae Hogan Monroe, with the family connected to the Dublin, Ireland area. At Fox, besides the name change, which was required so it could have more flair, according to Lyon, Marilyn became a platinum blonde, and representation arrived in the person of Johnny Hyde of the prestigious William Morris Agency. First-hand knowledge of Marilyn's persona during this time comes from actress Kara Williams, who worked briefly with Marilyn at 20th Century Fox in the 1940s. Williams is best known for her outstanding role as Billy's mother in The Defiant Ones, 1958, which earned her a Best Supporting Actress Academy Award nomination. Williams also earned an Emmy Award nomination for her role as Gladys Porter on the 1960-1962 CBS television series Pete and Gladys. During a May 2020 interview with this author, Williams, at 94 years old, said she and Marilyn sometimes shared the makeup room at Fox. She would look in the mirror while they were fixing her hair and make faces, smiles, frowns, lips in this position or that, her mouth just perfect, I guess to see what particular face would look the best in the film she was working on. Williams added, "I thought to myself, this woman can't act, she's more consumed with her self-image." Williams was also aware, she said, of Marilyn's reputation. "I knew she had done the nude photographs by Tom Kelly because I posed for him too, but not nude. I would never do that. And I knew she had slept around with this executive and that. She was nice to me, but I didn't want to be her friend." Williams also met Marilyn's mother, Gladys, but under disheartening circumstances. "A friend of mine was a mental patient, and I visited her at a farm outside L.A. As I was leaving, there was a woman standing in the yard all by herself. It was a very nice day, not too hot, but I noticed she had on this large hat. As I walked by her, I said, 'Why are you wearing a hat?' And she replied, 'Because it might rain,' even though there wasn't a cloud in the sky." Williams added, "I thought that was rather strange, but realized the woman was troubled, a mental patient. As I walked to my car, an attendant said to me, 'You know who that is, don't you? That's Marilyn Monroe's mother.'" Bernice Miracle, Marilyn's half-sister and next of kin when she died, published My Sister Marilyn, written with her daughter Mona in 1994. The book must be given credence since it is a true primary source account of Marilyn's life and times from birth to when she died. However, the question as to whether Bernice and Mona are biased as close relatives of Marilyn's must also be considered. Regardless, insights into the early years of Marilyn's life are revealing, such as her inability to save money. Bernice wrote, "Norma Jean told me that she was supposed to save a percentage of her salary under contract with Fox. That was standard for minors, but Norma Jean spent all her salary anyway and didn't save anything. Looking back, I have to think that her inability to budget was the beginning of her later financial troubles." Bernice recalled that Norma Jean could only afford a small collection of clothes. She bought only the best. And that she got up early and pressed her skirt before she went to work. She said most of the starlets came to work in slacks or were sloppily dressed, but she thought it was very important to look neat from the start. Bernice said that Marilyn learned to use the proper makeup, but concerning her own looks, she said, "I can't put makeup on my hands, though. I can't do anything but hide them or turn them at angles. My hands are like duck feet, big flat webs, and my ears are worse than my hands. See how thin they are on the tops? Like paper. I never wear my hair back if I can help it." Marilyn's objections to her figure apparently didn't hurt her ability to appear in photos, including in advertising campaigns. One photo shows her next to a friendly skeleton in a fake physician's office, date unknown. When the nude photos of Marilyn hit the streets, reactions varied both with the public and the media, with Kilgallen probably as shocked as anyone. But instead of ending Marilyn's career, the photos skyrocketed her to fame. Rave reviews for a calendar with her nude figure imprinted on it propelled it to worldwide success, making it arguably the most famous calendar of its kind in history. At the time, Monroe was short of cash, with a car payment looming, and the starlet, just days away from her 23rd birthday, had agreed to pose nude for $50 for photographer Tom Kelly. The photo featuring Monroe against a red velvet background appeared in the first issue of Playboy in 1953. Of the experience, Marilyn wrote in My Story, "Sitting naked in front of the camera and striking joyous poses reminded me of the dreams I used to have as a child." She explained that she only agreed to Mr. Kelly's request out of desperation, as she believed nice girls did not pose in the nude. Meanwhile, Marilyn had signed with Columbia Pictures at $100 a week. Movie roles in Dangerous Years, 1947, Glamour Preferred, 1948, and Ladies of the Chorus, 1949, ensued. Bernice said Marilyn's bit part in Love Happy, a Marx Brothers comedy, made the biggest impact and led to her getting a volume of the book An Actor Prepares by Konstantin Stanislavski, so she could study the method by which actors drew on their emotions and experiences to create realistic characterizations. In 1951, Marilyn appeared in Hometown Story, As Young as You Feel, Love Nest, and Let's Make It Legal. A year later, the news broke that Marilyn wasn't really an orphan at all, that the story had been made up for publicity purposes. The studio press releases tried to calm the criticism by stating that Marilyn's mother was unknown to her as a child because her mother had spent many years as an invalid in a state mental hospital. Her fans didn't seem to mind the ruse. She was getting upwards of 10 cartons of fan mail a week. Regarding the switch from being a model to being an actress, Marilyn had written in My Story, "I knew nothing about acting. I had never read a book about it or tried to do it or discussed it with anyone. But there was this secret door in me, acting. It was like being in jail and looking at a door that said, 'This way out.'" She added, "Acting was something golden and beautiful. It's an art. It was like a game you played that enabled you to step out of the dull world you knew into worlds so bright they made your heart leap just to think of them." But her aspirations had been initially crushed in 1950 when her agent, Johnny Hyde, enamored with Marilyn to the point of proposing marriage, broke the bad news to her that director John Huston had decided not to cast her in the film The Asphalt Jungle, The City Under the City. Hyde told Marilyn, "Huston said you're not star material. He says you're not photogenic, that you haven't got the sort of looks that make a movie star." Fortunately, Huston had a change of mind, and Marilyn appeared in the film noir as Angela Finlay, a sexy blonde who, despite appearing in only three scenes, the first at 23 minutes and 8 seconds, stole the show as the plaything to the devious, balding, famed attorney named Alonzo Emmerich, Louis Calhern, who called her "some sweet kid" in this scene. youtube.com/watch?v=lowercase e=lowercase w, uppercase e, lowercase r, lowercase e, uppercase s, lowercase j, uppercase p, lowercase y, uppercase c, 4. Marilyn's character became his phony alibi when police investigated Emmerich's part in a jewelry heist while he rationalized his behavior with the clever line, "Crime is only a left-handed form of human behavior." When the authorities finally confront Marilyn's character with either jail or the truth after Uncle Lon promises her a trip to Cuba, where she imagined wearing my new green bathing suit, yipes, Marilyn, wearing a low-cut black dress complete with sparkling jewels around her neck, then delivers one of her most memorable lines in that sultry voice of hers to a cop pressing her to change her story. "Haven't you bothered me enough, you big banana head?" Despite Marilyn's brief appearance, the movie studio created a flashy poster, not only splashing her image across the front, but giving her first billing ahead of Sterling Hayden, a big star at the time. One year after The Asphalt Jungle, Marilyn appeared in Hometown Story. She played Secretary Iris Martin in a newspaper office, and through the sultry voice and prominent view of her large breasts, she was typecast in an all too often sexual manner. One line she utters when a reporter, played by Alan Hale, gets a bit too friendly is memorable. Miss Martin tells him, "I always treat men with respect, then they treat me with respect." In real life, if that had only been true.